for support. The phones are open. There is room for your call. Help keep up the momentum. Call 713-526-5738. I'd like to thank all who called in to support KPFT and Arab Voices. It's not too late to call 713-526-5738 or donate online at kpft.org. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
KBOO Portland.
Today on Wings, the topic is Lois Weber, groundbreaking creator of silent films about women, and some of the other women with whom she worked.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This is Mary O'Grady for Wings. By 1910, audiences worldwide were flocking to a new form of entertainment, moving pictures, shown in a new kind of theater, a movie theater or cinema. These films did not have their own sound. Title cards carried dialogue and live musicians accompanied the action on screen. Today's film buffs know the names of movie pioneers like Cecil B. DeMille and D.W. Griffith, but who were the women movie makers in Hollywood's silent era? What happened to their productions? I'm talking to art historian Catherine Manthorn of the City University of New York. Professor Manthorn, how do you describe your research interests?
Well, I define them rather broadly as the art and history of the Americas in the 19th and 20th centuries. But I like to investigate around the edges of that field and identify individuals or trends that other people don't really pay so much attention to. So when I was starting my career, most of the emphasis was on white male artists. We looked at the Hudson River School, the expeditionary artists who went west, the Ashcan School, abstract expressionists. It all seemed to be part of a male club from which the women were excluded. So when I began to investigate the post-Civil War New York art scene, I kept coming upon the name Eliza Pratt Greatorex, and it turned out that she was the best-known female artist working in America prior to Mary Cassatt. She was the leader of a whole network of women, including her own artist daughters, and I had never heard of any of them. So I set out to find more about her and eventually was able to tell her story. My film interest really developed in a similar way. I was convinced that moving pictures first came along in 1896 and that painters and other artists were watching them and learning from them. They would have been so curious. And also the people in this new movie business, they really didn't know what they were doing either. They were starting out on the ground floor. So they would have been looking at paintings and illustration. So I began to look across, back and forth across the fine arts and movies as part of a continuum that people would have really absorbed. And this is how I got involved with this topic of film and modern art. And when I wrote my book, I actually included a whole chapter on the women in the early 20th century business.
You've written and spoken about the work of Lois Weber, an early film director. Could you talk a little about her career in Hollywood?
Sure. First, we just have to keep in mind, I think, that women were cinematic pioneers. When I learned how many women were really in film in this early period, I was totally blown away. There were more women involved in Hollywood in its first two decades than there have been at any time since. So when I learned about Lois Weber, I was very excited. So I'll just mention two books that are absolutely indispensable for anyone interested in Weber. One is by Shelley Stamp, Lois Weber in Early Hollywood. And there is also a compendium by Martin Norden. He put together all her interviews and articles. So, Mary, we have to go back to the silent era. Moving pictures had only been around 10 years when Lois Weber began working in film about 1907, along with her husband, Philip Smalley. By 1912, they moved to Universal Pictures. And we think of movies taking years and years and costing millions and millions of dollars. But when they were starting out, they had to produce one or two movies a week. Granted, one reelers, but still, that's a lot. So they took charge of the Rex brand within the Universal Pictures, and they put together a stock company of actors so that they could feel comfortable working with them and everybody could collaborate together. And soon they made Rex the most accomplished division for Universal. But they began to get frustrated because these one-reel movies were a maximum of 15 minutes. So they didn't have a lot of opportunity to develop plots and things like that. So they started pushing. They wanted to make multi-reel films. And in 1914, they made a very impressive four-reel production of Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice. And this is what really established Weber's reputation as one of the first women to direct a feature film. So she was really, I'm arguing, influenced by the fine arts. Her moving pictures are extremely beautiful and visually compelling. And also keep in mind, when movies first started, they were just considered low-class entertainment. They were called Nickelodeons, 5 cents. And you could sit there all day if you wanted to. So this was more for working-class people. And as Weber starts to make her movies as a woman and a very respectable and well-positioned woman, this helps to elevate movies in general. So in those days, people jumped from one company to another if they got a better offer. And Weber and Smalley ended up moving from Universal to another company called Hobart Bosworth Productions. And there she made a movie, Hypocrites, which I want to talk about if we have time. But soon they ended up going back to Universal, and this is where Weber really starts to take more and more control of her movies. She always talked about herself as a writer, and so she would write her own scripts. I mean, sometimes she would base them on stories from magazines or news articles, but she wrote her own script. In some of her early movies, she actually acted in them. Then she's working behind the scenes with the camera, working with the cameraman, selecting costumes and sets, and she even insisted on writing the intertitles so that she could use whatever particular type of look she wanted for the print or the font, but she also wanted to be able to control exactly what words were described on the screen. And again, this was very unusual. Most directors or movie makers at the time would just turn that over to someone else. So at this time, she's really being discussed in the same breath as some of the major male directors known at the time, D.W. Griffith and DeMille. And then, to make this even more exciting, in 1917, she set up her own production company, Lois Weber Productions, that thrived about 5 years until she and Philip Smalley divorced. But tastes were changing at the time. The public wanted more romance and light comedy, and some of her work went out of favor. So by 1939, when she passed away, she was no longer even making movies, and her moment had sort of passed for a while until she was rediscovered in recent years.
Well, please tell me a little bit about this feature she made, Hypocrites.
Well, Hypocrites is really fascinating because this was one of their movies that faced a lot of trouble with the censors. She was constantly frustrated by the censors, as you can well imagine, because she made movies on abortion, wage equity, white slavery, birth control. And at the time, different states had different censorship laws. So for her movies to go to one state, she might have to make some changes. For another state, different changes. So it was very frustrating and difficult. But Hypocrites was a fascinating film because she wanted to expose the hypocrisy in society. And so she used the figure of truth circulating among all different groups of people, and she would hold up the mirror of truth to them, and this would expose their sins and evils. So you say, okay, nothing to censor there, right? But here's the catch. Truth was a naked woman played by a well-known physical culturist, what they called physical culturist at the time, named Margaret Edwards. So people still debate whether Edwards wore a body stocking or whether she was completely nude, but we know that Weber used process shots to project the nude figure so that she looked kind of ghost-like and translucent. So this was one of the earliest instances of full frontal nudity on film, albeit it was done in double exposure. So at the time, it was banned in some places, and she was forced to cut out parts to be shown. But she was very clever in the way she presented herself to the public. She would always be in her home, sitting with her husband, and presenting herself as a very respectable married woman, talking about her domestic chores as much as her home life. And so in this way, I think she shielded herself and her work so that some of the things that she did, like using this nude figure, were sort of forgiven in some circles because they thought of her as being very respectable and moral. And so they thought that the nude figure was, in fact, serving this higher moral purpose. And she was able to kind of sometimes get a little leeway because of her image.
Let's talk a little bit about her feature, which was titled simply Shoes. It dealt with the extreme poverty of a young female shop clerk who was the sole support of her family. What struck you the most about Shoes?
Well, Shoes is one of my favorite movies by her that are known. I should say she made probably hundreds of movies, and only a few of them are still around today, reconstituted and made available to the public. So we're only talking about a small percentage of her whole production. But the storyline of Shoes is relatively simple. We have the innocent young Eva working in a 5 and 10 cent store, and she's providing income for her entire family because her lazy father sits around all day and refuses to work, and her mother stays home with her three younger sisters. So Eva's standing on her feet all day. And keep in mind that back in the 1915, 1916, that would have been probably a 14-hour day with one short break, a half an hour break for lunch. And then when electric illumination came along and became more widely used in these stores, the day was even longer. So her shoes are, all through the movie, we see her shoes deteriorating. But the family, every week her mother promises her, okay, I'm going to take some money out of your salary this week so you can buy shoes. But every week they have to pay the rent or pay the butcher. And so Eva struggles along, but eventually she accepts the advances of a man who would pay for her favors. So as the movie says, she sold herself for a pair of shoes. But what I find, you know, so in the hands of some directors, that type of story could be, you know, sort of preachy. Who would really want to go and see this? You know, it's a sort of fallen woman story. But Weber makes it so compelling. And I'll just give one example of what I find so amazing, and I hope some of you can find this and be able to watch it yourselves. But she really makes us aware of our feet. She uses unusual camera angles and innovative framing to make shoes the focus of the movie. So early shots of, we look down at Eva's shoes and we just cringe to think of how uncomfortable they must be. Then Weber cuts to beautiful, fashionable new shoes worn by the elegant, rich ladies who are going shopping. But it's on this one day when Eva leaves the house and her shoes are just getting worse and worse. She walks out the door and it's pouring rain. So again, the shoes are even going to get more deteriorated. But Weber, what Weber does is just visually so stunning. She positions the camera very low to the ground and uses long tracking shots. So we're watching Eva's footsteps as she sloshes through the puddles. And we can literally kind of feel, I think, the dirty water seeping into her shoe and as their poorly repaired shoes are disintegrating. So then we're told it rained for the next couple of days and we kind of shudder even more. So this is the kind of thing that Weber does, that she elevates the story and makes us feel everything that her characters are feeling. And I think that's what makes Shoes so completely amazing, especially for its time.
While I was watching Shoes, I was reminded of the fact that female retail employees in the U.S. are typically not allowed to sit down during their working hours. Did anything in this film remind you of working women's struggles which continue now?
Yes, it's really rather sad. Here we are over 100 years after the movie Shoes was made, and women in retail are still standing on their feet all day and not being paid a living wage. I mean, I've talked to people who say, yes, I worked in stores, and we were not even allowed to sit down behind the counter or in the shop, even if customers were not in there. But in 1916, there were even fewer laws protecting workers suffering these long hours or low pay. And it also struck me, not just people who work in shops, but recently the pandemic has really hit home for all of us, the unfair conditions for the healthcare workers. Perhaps if we had never gone to a hospital or had a loved one in a hospital, we didn't think so much about the healthcare workers. But because of this, they became visible. And I think in 1916, it was the same thing. You know, there were many workers being treated poorly, seamstresses, maids, many other people. But it was because the shop girls were in public. They were so visible, standing behind the counter and surrounded by all these goods that they're selling, that they became sort of symbolic. So you get a lot of stories in the magazines, different movies. Clara Bow, who was a big star in the 1920s, made a movie called It. And she was called the It Girl, and she was also a shop girl.
This is Mary O'Grady for Wings. I'm talking to Professor Catherine Manthorn of the City University of New York. Tell me a bit about Lois Weber's battles with the censors.
Yeah, you know, many of the different topics that she dealt with drove the censors crazy. Several of her movies that are now lost were about abortion and birth control, and one of them was thought to be almost telling the story of Margaret Sanger. So these movies would frustrate the censors, and you know, these are not stories that clergy or other civic leaders really wanted to be told. And so she did have quite a struggle to adapt her movies to the different markets. But she never really let go of her principles. That's the thing that I find so amazing about her and so worthy of our attention, is that each time she had that struggle, she would do whatever she needed to do to make sure that the movie could still reach the public. But the next movie, she would go back and take on even more controversial issues. So she sort of helped, I think, to break down some of the barriers about censorship and the kinds of things that could be shown on screen. She had come from a sort of a Salvation Army type of background. She had worked with these groups for a while, and she had seen how these women suffered and wanted to tell their stories. And she even says she conceives of movies as sermons on screen. So she wants to get across these messages in a way that people will want to actually watch and on some level move beyond just the notion of a moral tale.
And her work does not come off at all puritanical.
Oh, no. For example, she made another movie with Anna Pavlova, the famous ballerina, and it's the only record we have on film of this dancer, this wonderful dancer. And it was called The Dumb Girl of Portici, dumb meaning she couldn't speak. And that was set in 17th century Naples in Italy. And so again, Weber is telling the story about this young girl who was led on by a man, and then afterwards he wants to make sure that she doesn't let his well-to-do family know about it. So again, there's a moral at the center of the story, but it's visually so amazing the kind of sets she created to put us into 17th century Naples, the way also she uses the camera to focus so much on Pavlova and her beautiful movements. So in each case, there is the seed of a lesson that is very important to Weber herself, but she always coats her moral lesson in a very lush and beautiful set, in the case of The Dumb Girl, or visually compelling scenes from the Woolworths in the case of Shoes. But it's always fascinating to look at, and she was very well known for realism. You know, she talks about the fact that she wanted to use actual places and not just build movie sets to, again, convince the viewer and put us there with her characters.
Was she able to keep control over the film she made?
Well, that's a great question, the whole issue of control, because She was very adept at every single aspect of movie making. She wrote the scripts. She was on site all the time, directing all the action. She could actually operate the cameras. She wrote the intertitles. So because she had knowledge of all those different things, she didn't have to relegate. She could keep control of every aspect of what she was doing. And for a while, the studios let her do that. In spite of the controversy and censorship, her movies still did incredibly well. So when she was making The Dumb Girl of Portici with Anna Pavlova, at the time, that was the biggest budget for a movie that Universal had ever allocated. So they trusted her to be able to spend the money in a way that was going to bring them back profits. So again, that shows to me that on the one hand, she's this auteur, as they were often called, this idea of the movie maker who can control everything. But at the same time, she was incredibly adept at understanding what she needed to do to keep the studio happy and to make money. And, you know, working with powerful personalities. I mean, imagine working with Anna Pavlova, a huge star. She had her own ballet company. She managed a very large troupe of workers who she was responsible for. You can imagine these two hugely successful and creative women collaborating. Must have really enjoyed each other's company, I think.
Did filmmaking women in Hollywood's silent era often collaborate and network?
I think that was a really strong part of how women were able to negotiate this whole system. Weber started out working in the studio of Alice Guy Blaschet, almost certainly the first woman to direct a film. Working first in France, she made a one-minute movie called The Cabbage Fairy of 1896. And then she makes longer movies and then moved to the United States and founded her own company, Solax. And this is where Weber got her start, this female production company. Then around 1914, a woman named Frances Marion came knocking on Weber's door wanting work. And Weber gave Marion her start in the film industry. And I don't know if that name is familiar to listeners, but Frances Marion was a screenwriter in Hollywood. She wrote over 325 scripts and went on to work with many different women, including, you know, Mary Pickford, Greta Garbo, Marlena Dietrich, Marion Davies, the Gish sisters, the list goes on and on. So once Weber got her start from Guy Blaschet, then she helps other women, including Marion. And Weber was also known for discovering female talent and nurturing them. So Mary McLaren, who is the young woman who played the part in Shoes, she had never been in a movie before. Weber liked to find people who, you know, she thought fit the part, and she found Mary and was very impressed with her and then helped her to find other parts. So, you know, all these instances give you the idea that these women were very much integrated together into their own network that was operating at the same time as they also had to work, of course, with the men in the industry.
How did the movie industry change in the waning years of the 1920s, and what did those changes mean for women directors?
Well, sadly, it really meant that a lot of the women directors were driven out. I'll just give three points about what was going on in the 20s. Of course, talkies come in around 1927. It's usually cited that Al Jolson in The Jazz Singer was the first movie that had any sound, but that changed the entire business. You know, actors had to speak on film, and some of them discovered that their voices did not project well at all, and their careers were basically over. Clara Bow, the person I mentioned before, she was a huge star in the 20s, and as soon as sound came along, she had this terrible Brooklyn accent, and nobody wanted to listen to her. But directors also had to learn new techniques to coordinate the sound and the pictures. So Lois Weber had worked for, you know, almost 20 years in silent movies, and when she tries to transition over to sound, it wasn't very successful. So that's one point. But we also have to keep in mind that, as we were saying, movies evolved from being low-class entertainment to a staple of the middle class. So, you know, as it becomes a moves up in the world, so to speak, in the social hierarchy, that of course means it's bigger and bigger business, much more lucrative. So it's often argued that a lot of men who had never paid much attention before to this industry suddenly wanted to control the field. And it's especially frustrating because it was a lot of the female directors, like Lois Weber, who had helped to make movies more appealing to women and to middle-class audiences, and then they're being shut out. And the third and final point I'll mention is that in the early days, movie making were small operations all over the country. You know, it was kind of like a cottage industry in a way initially. New York, Fort Lee, New Jersey, Las Vegas, New Mexico, all these different places were little pockets of movie making. But by the teens, business starts to move to California, and then Hollywood was born. And with Hollywood, the studio system, where a few large studios controlled not only movie production, but they would have chains of movie theaters all over the country. So they're making sure that sort of cha-ching, cha-ching, everything they do is making, putting more money in their pockets. So they didn't want to take risks on movies like Weber's social issue films or controversial films that could risk censorship and therefore loss of profits. So all these things are in the wind, so to speak, and really driving women to the periphery of the field where they had previously just been right at the center of everything.
So many films of the silent era have been lost. How did that happen?
Well, it's really sad. I mean, some estimates claim that 80 to 90% of the silent movies that were made are lost forever. One major factor was the common use of nitrate film, which was used all the way up until the 1950s. This type of film was highly flammable, and there have been devastating fires, not only in the movie theaters themselves, where sometimes the people in the projection booth would have a fire there, but also in the different film studios in their storage areas. So Universal Pictures, for example, in 1924, there was a huge fire, Fox in 37, and so much of what was in their vault, saving these old movies, that was all lost. But also, once the talkies came along, it was almost like silent pictures weren't considered valuable anymore. Oftentimes, they were just junked as studios cleared out vaults to make room to store newer movies. We all know there's never enough storage space, right? So they just figured that wasn't really worth worrying about. But also, you have to think about the way the movies were distributed at the time. A copy of Shoes would be sent to, say, New York City, and then with the instructions that after they were finished watching it, send it to Pittsburgh and then to Atlanta and so on. So at some point, it reached the end of the line, and sometimes it was just never returned. It was just sat around somewhere. But the good news is that some of these movies are continually being found, a fragment here or there, and sometimes they even find the screenplays. So this is what tells the experts how to put these movies back together. So there's really important work going on at the Library of Congress, at iFilm in the Netherlands, Lobster Films. All this is done by these people who are so dedicated to sort of reconstructing every frame of the film and as much as possible simulate the experience of watching it in the 19-teens. And that's why some of these DVD sets that are available now with Weber's movie and others are just so remarkable because so much work went into that reconstruction. There are many different opportunities, especially now silent film streaming. Sometimes film festivals have been online, but there are also some excellent, if you're a DVD person as I am, I like to have the physical thing. It's kind of amazing, many of the works that are out there, but I'll just mention one called The Pioneers, First Women Filmmakers, which is over 20 hours of movies directed by women. And there is a pamphlet or a small book that is included with it that tells you all about it. But another great resource is actually the Library of Congress. They have, from early on, become a very important resource for restoring silent movies. And if they have these movies on their website, you know, you can search them. A lot of the shorter ones, you can just download. But you can also request a copy. And, you know, it takes a little time, but you will eventually get a copy from the Library of Congress collections. But I would say also, join a film organization if you're at all interested in these things. The San Francisco Silent Film Festival, they have all kinds of information on their websites. If you join for just a small fee, you can receive these different links to watch features and things every month. So it's really wonderful. Of course, you can also read many, many books. Mary Pickford, she's an industry in herself, I think, for people writing about her. And there's another book by Steve Massa called Slapstick Divas about women in comedy film. So that could give you a laugh.
I've been talking to Professor Catherine Manthorn of the City University of New York. Listeners can find out more about early women filmmakers from Catherine Manthorn's recent book, Film and Modern American Art. For Wings, this is Mary O'Grady.
To hear this program again, email wings@wings.org. Wings also has a daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, who hosts video salons with notable speakers through the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's maternalgifteconomymovement, all one word, .org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
Welcome to Film at 11 here on Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Today we have a movie book or two, a new essay film, and a few classics. First, let's hear from Britta Gordon on a new film by Ulrika Ottinger.
Ich war 20 Jahre jung und mit dem festen Plan, eine große Künstlerin zu werden, nach Paris gekommen.
Sous le grand chapeau gris d'Away, mit all éclat dans son rire.
Sometimes the best memoirs come from small slivers of a person's life, the decompressing, the unpacking of a relatively narrow span of years allows for precision, focus, and time to interject a memorable digression or two. Such is the case for Ulrika Ottinger's Paris Calligram, which came out in 2020, just finished a virtual run at New York's Film Forum, and is now available to stream from Vimeo. Ottinger, who is 79, is a German artist and filmmaker, possibly a bit better known in Europe than in the United States. It's fairly difficult to find anything more than bits of her avant-garde experimental films on YouTube here, which is unfortunate. I'm hoping that this wonderful film memoir will work to change that. I'm also hoping Ottinger makes another one, at least one more.